We're going to take a break this morning from our study in the Sermon on the Mount. And the verse I'd like to start with is found in Philippians chapter 4. If you will turn there, we're going to read verse 8 and 9. Philippians chapter 4, verses 8 and 9. Paul writes, "Finally, brethren, whatever things are true, whatever things are noble, whatever things are just, whatever things are pure, whatever things are lovely, whatever things are of good report, if there is any virtue, and if there is anything praiseworthy, meditate on these things. The things which you learned and received and heard and saw in me, these do, and the God of peace will be with you." One of my really nice memories of growing up is that Mom would go to the Woolworth store in Rantoul, and she'd buy us boys books. And there was a series of books called the Whitman Children's Classics that she bought. I think some of them are still out at the farm. And she bought Tom Sawyer, Huckleberry Finn, Black Beauty, Heidi. Did any of you girls read Heidi? I don't think I read that one, but Mom bought it. The one I read the most was the 50 famous fairy tales in this book. And I read that thing till the covers almost fell off. And it was from the reading of that book that I really gained a love of fairy tales. And I've been involved with fairy tales even up to this very point in my life. And what I came to learn as I grew up, I didn't understand this as a child, but as I grew up, I came to learn that fairy tales, which almost every culture has their folklore, their fairy tales are imaginative retellings of the gospel story. Fairy tales are human reflections of the gospel story. In fairy tale, the issue is always between good and evil. Fairy tales always come with a moral. In fact, the only famous fairy tale that was not written with a moral by the author was Alice in Wonderland. There's no moral. There's just a bunch of adventures. No moral to any of it. And Lewis Carroll later regretted that he didn't write some kind of moral into the story. But every other fairy tale comes with a moral. The gingerbread man teaches you, don't take advice from strangers, people you don't know. And fairy tales had an active ingredient. In the Bible, that active ingredient is miracles. But in fairy tale, it's magic. And so I've come to appreciate how the fairy tales can shed light on many of the stories that we read about in the Bible. And probably the plot, the storyline that is the most popular in fairy tales, most popular in our entertainment, is the one involving the underdog. The heroic underdog up against some tremendous bully. Jack and the Beanstalk. This little rustic boy with some magic beans grows a beanstalk, traded the family cow for the beans, grows a beanstalk, climbs up it, encounters a giant. And that storyline of the little guy against the giant, that's the storyline in Rocky. That's the storyline in Karate Kid. That's the storyline in Hoosiers, one of my all-time favorite movies, Hoosiers. That's the storyline in Rudy, of where the little guy who doesn't stand a chance takes on some giant. And to show you how closely related fairy tales are sometimes to the Bible, turn to Revelation chapter 12. Because in this chapter, the inspired writer John almost uses fairy tale images to make a tremendous point about the cosmic battle between good and evil. I'm going to start reading in Revelation chapter 12, verse 1. "Now a great sign appeared in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun, with the moon under her feet, and on her head a garland of 12 stars. Then being with child, she cried out in labor and in pain to give birth. And another sign appeared in heaven. Behold, a great fiery red dragon, having seven heads and ten horns and seven diadems on his heads. His tail drew a third of the stars of heaven and threw them to the earth. And the dragon stood before the woman who was ready to give birth to devour her child as soon as it was born. Now that's a classic fairy tale storyline. Here's a very vulnerable, exposed individual, a woman who is pregnant. She's ready to give birth. She's having to deal with all of the extremities involved with that. And there is this gigantic red dragon. Now, probably the last time you read anything about a dragon was in a fairy tale. That's where you find dragons. This dragon is so big, when it wags its tail, verse 4 says, it knocks a third of the stars out of heaven. And in the story of Revelation, you know who it is who is sent out to fight this dragon? It's a lamb. You can drop down to verse 11 of chapter 12 to see that. It is a lamb, and it's not just a lamb. The Greek word means a little lamb. It's a little lamb that God sends out to take on this big dragon, and this big dragon is defeated by the lamb. Now, you know why it's important to talk about dragons and underdogs? Why it's important to talk about giants? It's because there are people who are still fighting giants. There are people who are still fighting dragons. There are underdogs. There are jacks of Jack and the Beanstalk. And there's situations and there are individuals that the jacks of this world come up against that it seems impossible for them to deal with. And that happens all the time. The other day I was talking to a little 8-year-old boy or so, and just out of the blue he told me, monsters live under his bed. I want to tell you, there's a lot of adults who think monsters live under their bed. They think there's some scenario, some situation, some individual that is a threat to them and is so big that the bad guy, the dragon, the giant, cannot fail. And they're the ones who are going to be the victims. And let me tell you some of the dragons, some of the giants that everyday people have to take on and deal with. Fear is a giant. Loneliness is a giant. Jealousy, lust, depression is a giant. Resentment, bitterness, grief, pain, rumor, envy, habits, pessimism. Some people are always pessimistic. Those are giants. And those things I just mentioned can seem so big to individuals as to be unbeatable. And there are people who every day struggle with the thought that one or more of those giants that I just mentioned is going to destroy them. They're in an impossible situation. They're intimidated by a circumstance, and they don't think there's any way that they're going to come out of it alive. They don't know what to do. Now, maybe a psychiatrist, they think, knows what to do. Maybe a psychologist. Maybe there's a bottle of pills, they think, that will somehow deal with the giant in their life. But there's a better answer, there's a better solution to dealing with giants than anything humanistic healers have to offer. This is not a criticism of anyone who's ever sought out the counsel of a psychiatrist or psychologist. But psychiatry and psychology, which were made up words using Greek terms, made up about 120 some years ago, all trace from Sigmund Freud, who was an aggressive atheist and described himself as a godless Jew. And to think that any philosophy he came up with for dealing with giants is something that's going to be of help, and people would turn to that guy and his disciples before they've turned to the Lord Jesus Christ for advice on dealing with giants is beyond me. But that's what happens sometimes. Now, I think the Bible has a better solution, a better answer to dealing with giants. And there is a classic story in the Bible. It's a story all of you know. It's a story from which Jack and the Beanstalk came, I think. It's the story of David and Goliath that talks about the underdog fighting a giant. And we're going to use that this morning as a template for anyone in any situation in life where they are the underdog up against something far bigger than they are. And so if you want to turn to 1 Samuel 17, I'm just going to tell you the story as it unfolds in 1 Samuel chapter 17. In the southwestern part of Israel, between the coastline and the mountains, there's a mountain range, the Anti-Lebanon Mountains, that run right through Israel like a spine. Jerusalem sits up on one of those mountains in that mountain range. But as you go down to the sea, you go through a section of foothills. And there are hills that run east-west, and they are separated by valleys. And these valleys are where most of the farming takes place. These valleys are where most of the battles fought in the Bible lands have taken place. And there is one valley in particular, the Valley of Elah. When I was over there a couple of years ago, we were in our van. I think we were heading up to Nazareth at the time. And all of a sudden, the van pulled over. We're in a rural area. And there's no signs or no big entryway or anything like that. The van just pulls off the road, pulls onto the dirt. And we get out, and our guide tells us we're at the Valley of Elah. And so we walk away from the road, and there is a ridge on the northern, on my left as I'm walking east, there's a ridge up there on the north, and maybe a quarter mile, maybe a half a mile to the south, I can see another line of mountains, and in between the ridge on the north and the mountains I see on the south is this nice flat valley, not more than a half a mile wide at any point. And we're told this is where David met Goliath. Up on the ridge to the north was the Israelite army. And that ridge, I'm guessing, thinking back, maybe 60 feet tall, 60, 70 feet tall. At the base of the ridge, there's this creek that ran along it. And then there's this plain, this valley, the Valley of Elah, and the mountains down there to the south. The Israelite army was up on the ridge. The Philistines were encamped to the south. And every day, the Philistines, who by the way were Caucasian, the Philistines would have probably looked like us. They had migrated from the island of Crete, which was Greek, in the Mediterranean Sea there. And they'd come to the mainland, which happened to be the land of Israel, where they came to. And they were starting to push their way in, taking over territory, occupying territory, to establish cities and build up their civilization. They were illegal aliens as far as the people in Israel were concerned, and they became the avowed enemies of the Israelites. And so they were always fighting Israelites, it seemed like. And so they've got this situation with the Israelites here and the Philistines here in this valley. And every day the Philistines sent out their nuclear weapon, a giant whose name was Goliath. This guy was over 9 feet tall. He was armored like a Sherman tank. He had three weapons. He had a javelin, he had a spear, he had a sword. And there was something about the spear that it wasn't just another long, pointy stick. It had some kind of catapult device involved where when he pressed the button, I guess, he could really pack a punch, go right through somebody. So he is armored, he has weapons, and he would come out, and with the Israelites up on the ridge looking down there on the he's pacing back and forth, cussing, blaspheming the God of Israel, defying the Israelites to send down their champion, and the two of them would fight, and the winner would take all. Now the Israelite champion should have been Saul the king. Saul was the giant in Israel. He was head and shoulders above everybody else, but he wasn't 9 foot tall. And he wasn't about to take on the Philistine giant. So for 40 days, and that's a significant number in the Bible, isn't it? 40? For 40 days, this giant is challenging the Israelites to send somebody down. And then the story goes that a young shepherd boy from Bethlehem, not too many miles away, Bethlehem was fairly close, shows up one day with care packages for his brothers. He's got a bunch of brothers who are in the army. And mom had fixed up some food to send, and the shepherd boy is detailed to carry the care packages to his brothers. And when he gets there and sees the situation, sees this giant come out, defying Israel, challenging Israel, and not a single Israelite taking up the challenge, the shepherd boy is horrified. He's embarrassed. He's ashamed. He can't understand why none of the good guys have gone down to take on this bad guy. And his brothers are dismissive of him. They try to shut him up. But the shepherd boy is so incensed. He finally says, well, if nobody else is going to do it, I'll do it. I'll go down and take him on. All the other Israelites were shaking in fear atop their ridge. I'm going to say more about fear in a minute. But the shepherd boy by the name of David says, I'll go down and deal with this fella. And Saul says, well, here, you need some armor. Try mine on. And Saul's armor was far too big for that shepherd boy. And the shepherd boy said, no, I don't need your armor. That's not the way I fight. The shepherd boy had a slingshot, a sling. And he works his way down that ridge to the creek at the bottom and picks up 5 smooth stones. I picked up a stone and brought it home. He picks up 5 smooth stones. And the giant is watching all of this, and the giant is insulted. He wanted Israel to send out their champion. And they send out a kid? And the giant says, what kind of a dog do you think I am that I'm not worthy of any more respect than you sending me this kid? Larry Bird, when he played in the NBA, if the team that the Celtics were playing against put a rookie on him, Larry was insulted. And he'd usually make that rookie pay. And Larry would go to the other coach and say, hey, you need to put your best guy on me, because I'm going to chew your rookie up and spit him out. And that's usually what Larry Bird did. And Goliath is the same way. Now, it would be to misunderstand the story if you thought that this is a teenage boy who doesn't have a lick of sense, who doesn't know better, going out to fight a battle he cannot win. If that's your idea of what's happening, you're completely wrong about what's happening. Here's what's happening. This giant wanted to get in a wrestling match with somebody. He wanted somebody close enough that his javelin or spear or sword could reach them. David had no intention whatsoever of getting that close. David had a slingshot. And let me tell you about those ancient slingers. Not just in the Hebrews, among the Hebrews, but in other cultures as well. Those guys with a sling, it wasn't a slingshot like we're used to. It's just a strap of leather that they could fit a rock into one end of it and do that. Those guys got so good at slinging a stone and hitting their target that Judges 20 verse 16 said that there were 700 men in the tribe of Benjamin who could hit a hair from a distance with their slingshot. Now, a major league pitcher may be able to throw a ball 100 miles an hour and hit your head. But just pluck one hair out of your head and set it up for him to hit that hair. These guys in Benjamin with slingshots could hit the hair. It's been said that in other armies, other societies, men got so good they could bring down a bird that was in flight with their slingshot. David did not intend to ever get within arm's reach of that giant. The giant kept saying, "Hey, come over here, come to me, where I can grab you." If Goliath had ever grabbed him, it would have been all over for David. But David was not going to let that happen. There's a great scene in Indiana Jones and the Ark of the Covenant where Indiana is in this Arab village in North Africa there somewhere, and this Arab warrior, the crowd parts, and there's this Arab warrior with a scimitar sword. And that guy pulls it out, and he's flashing it all around, and he's going to take off Indiana Jones' head. And then Indy looks at that, and he pulls out his gun and shoots him. That's what is going on in 1 Samuel 17. That's the correct understanding of this. David pulls out his slingshot, lets it fly. It hits the giant in the only exposed part of his body. Everything else was covered by armor. That was not a lucky shot. That's where David meant to hit him. And the impact of that rock hitting him right here so stunned him that the giant falls on the ground. And the shepherd boy runs up, and while the giant is stunned and helpless, pulls his sword out and chops off his head. Now, in all of that story, we learn how to kill a giant. And the giant I want to talk about just briefly is the giant of fear. Because that's a monster under the bed that so many people cower before. What is fear? Fear is the appearance of something, anything that threatens you. And it doesn't just threaten you. You don't think you're able to stop it from taking you out. It's bigger than you are. You don't have the wherewithal to take it on. And because you're afraid that it will destroy you, the emotion that comes as a result is fear. Have you ever been around a fire that scared you? I have. I had to get rid of a pheasant house I had on the property one time, and I thought the easiest way to get rid of it was to set it on fire. I set it on fire. And that thing, I mean, that became a maelstrom. And it scared me. But I turn on a burner on my stove, that fire doesn't scare me because it's under control. I can turn it off. I can turn it on, turn it down. I can turn it off. I'm in control. But when you're in a situation where you have no control over the situation, like coming up against a giant, that's when fear comes. And fear is the monster under the bed for many people. And you deal with fear the same way you deal with a giant. And let me tell you the steps, we'll close with this. Let me tell you the steps that David took to kill the giant, which are the same steps that people can take to deal with fear. C.S. Lewis said this about fear. He said, it begins with a mental image that leads to a physical reaction. Fear is when you think you're facing a giant. Fear is when you think you're facing a dragon. Fear is the monster under the bed. That's how you imagine it. And imagining it that way, it's bigger than you. It's too big to fail. And becoming obsessed by that monster in your thinking, in your thoughts, becoming captured by that, you might develop an ulcer. You might get a migraine. You might deal with paralysis. You just can't move. I remember a friend of mine went to see Jaws when it came out back in, what, 76, something like that. And he's 6'4", he's a big guy. He said when that movie ended and he stood up, he couldn't move. He had been so tense from watching that, he could not move. That's what fear does. It paralyzes. Fear can give you anxiety. It can give you worry. It can give you cowardice. Fear can make a coward out of you. And so how do you deal with the giant of fear or any other giant? Step one. You don't listen to your fears. All of the Israelites were listening to their fear and they said, we're not going down there. There was one boy who refused to listen to his fear. I went through a spell in my life where every twitch I got, I thought was cancer. Every twitch. And there were times I could barely function. I let that thought take hold of me and I obsessed on that thought. I was running to the doctor about every other week. It got to where when he saw me coming in, he started laughing. I didn't know what he's laughing at. What he's laughing at was how stupid I was. I let that fear take hold of me, and what I finally came to realize is that my fear was lying to me. My fear says that twitch is cancer. My twitches have never been anything more than just twitches. Fear will lie to you. It will tell you, you're not capable of dealing with this. It will tell you, this is going to destroy you. This is going to ruin you. You're in a situation you cannot control, you cannot get out of. Fear will tell you what you're facing is far bigger than it really is. It will tell you, you are far smaller than you really are. Far more helpless than you really are. The first step is to stop listening to your fear. Step two, instead of listening to fear, listen to God. Here's what God says. When fear says you're not capable of dealing with this, God says this is the victory that overcomes the world, even your faith. If by faith you can overcome the world, you can overcome every giant that's in the world. God says that we by ourselves may be small, but we by ourselves with Him can deal with any situation that arises. Elijah on Mount Carmel was facing 850 false prophets of Baal, but it wasn't 850-1. That's not the correct ratio. It was 850-1 plus God. And the faith of Elijah gained the victory over all of those false prophets. Don't listen to your fear. Listen to God. And listen to God, number three, when He says that perfect love casts out fear. 1 John 4:18. Love and fear, according to John, are mutually exclusive. When you are gripped by fear, you are focusing on yourself. You are self-absorbed. You are obsessed with yourself. When you are focusing on love, you're focusing on someone else. You're thinking about someone else, how you can be of help to them. Love thinks no evil. The only thing fear does think is evil. Love is so busy living today, it doesn't have time to worry about tomorrow. Fear is so caught up with what if. Fear deals with, well, what if it's cancer? What if it's this? What if it's that? What might happen in the future, that fear renders you almost helpless in the present. The Bible's solution to fear is to love someone else. Carl Menninger, the famous psychiatrist back in Kansas in the middle part of the 1900s, had a clinic, the Menninger Clinic. He said when somebody comes and tells them they're dealing with fear, depression, anxiety, the prescription he writes for them is this: go home, walk out your front door, walk across the street, find somebody on the other side of the street who could use your help, and help them. And that will take care of your fear. So number one, don't listen to your fear. Number two, listen to God. Number three, listen to God when He says love will cast out fear. And number four, go back now to Philippians chapter 4 that we started with. Number four, take control of your thoughts. These giants that we've been talking about appear when our thoughts get out of control. And here's some hard facts. We are what we think about. Our thoughts determine the person we are. And if we think we're some puny little jack who cannot take on the giant at the top of the beanstalk, we're going to be a puny little jack, characterized by cowardice and depression and despondency. What we think about creates the atmosphere that we live in and breathe. Our thoughts are what produce fear. And the sling that we take out to kill the giant of fear is our willpower. We have the ability of bringing our thoughts under control, of determining what we're going to think about. I tell people to go to Philippians 4:8 and make a list, have a list that they carry with them of true things. Make a list of noble things. Make a list of just things, pure things, lovely things, good report things. And you keep that list on you. And when you realize your mind has drifted to some fear, you pull that list out, pick one of the things on the list, and force your minds, because you can do that, you have the willpower to determine what you'll think about, you force your mind onto something good, noble, pure, just, of good report, true, some virtue, and you take your mind back. Paul says, think on these things. And what happens, verse 9, when you think on them and act on them, the God of peace will be with you. Peace will come back to your soul. Peace will come to your heart. Peace will come to your life when you determine to take control of your thoughts and to act. Verse 8 says, think right. Verse 9 says, do right. The things you're thinking about, do. You think right, you do right, and peace comes. And that's how you deal with the giants that you encounter today. When I was growing up, not long after the Korean War, there used to be a lot of talk about brainwashing. Remember that? American soldiers captured and were brainwashed by the Koreans. Mind control. That's where the devil plays the game. He tries to capture your mind. He tries to feed you all these lies. He's the father of lies. The only thing he ever tells you is a lie. And if he can get you to believe the lies, then boy, he's got you. And the counterattack is to take control of your mind and think on the virtues that Paul mentions. The only thing God ever tells us to fear in the Bible is himself. Not in a cowardly way, but in a way of respect and submission and awe. And if we fear God to take his word seriously and to practice it, you'll be amazed at the number of giants you can take out. How to kill a giant? Let the example of David and his son, Jesus Christ, be the example that guides us in this great endeavor of life in dealing with giants.